This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, health policy researcher Thomas Moore told us the story of how a drug designed to treat people with irregular heartbeats, or arrhythmias, actually led to cardiac arrest in many patients. Moore criticized the FDA for overlooking the dangers of the drug when it was first approved in 1985. 4 years later, a study by the National Institutes of Health led the FDA to place more restrictions on the drug's use. Moore says this story raises larger questions about how drugs are tested, approved, and marketed. We called Dr. Robert Temple, the director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. He made the final decision to approve the drug Moore wrote about. The chemical name is fecinide acetate. It's marketed under several different brand names. I asked Dr. Temple to respond to Thomas Moore's criticisms of how the FDA approved the arrhythmia drugs.
Well, his analysis is complicated. Let me give my bottom line. We believe that we approved the drug for two claims that were adequately supported by the data at the time, and that there was nothing unusual or odd about it. I should say what the two claims were, because that's important. First, we approved the drug for use in people with life-threatening abnormal rhythms of the heart. There's really no controversy about whether that should have been done. Everybody agrees with that. We also approved it for certain people with symptoms associated with their abnormal rhythms, even though those people were not at immediate risk of death. We approved it in people who were so symptomatic that their physicians and they thought that the benefits of using the drug outweighed the risks of the drug, and those risks were clearly described in labeling and included the possibility of dying. So we approved a narrow section, a narrow claim in symptomatic patients. We never, under any circumstances, suggested in labeling, and the company didn't either, that the drug should be used in people who had abnormal rhythms that could be seen on an electrocardiogram, but that were not either symptomatic or life-threatening.
So what confuses me here is, why would you want to approve a drug for people who are at great risk, knowing that the drug might only increase the risk of death?
Well, you didn't know that the drug would increase the risk of death. What you knew is that some people got worse, but of course many people got better. The difficulty is that when people have immediately life-threatening arrhythmias, that is, these are arrhythmias that will kill them today, you have to make them go away. You can't keep shocking a person or defibrillating a person over and over and over again. You have to do something. And it's regrettable but true that all of the drugs that you use to try to do that make some people worse. That's one of the reasons you start people like that on a drug in the hospital, in the hope that you can tell whether the drug makes them worse, and therefore then you wouldn't use that drug. You'd try to find another one. So it wasn't that the drugs, on the average, make everybody worse, then of course you wouldn't use it, but that one possible adverse consequence of using the drug was making it worse. Now remember, it was only approved for people whose symptoms were so bothersome that it was worth taking a drug that had these risks associated with it. The physician and patient needed to make that decision. But if they did make that decision, we thought the evidence was good enough to allow the use in those people, those carefully selected people. You know, you have to know people with these conditions, but abnormal heart rhythms, even if they don't threaten to kill you, can be totally immobilizing. People can sit all day concentrating on the turmoil that's going on in their chest and just be immobilized. So there are some people in which there is a great gain from treating symptoms. I need to emphasize again, the labeling and we never recommended use of the drug in people who didn't have serious symptoms, solely for the purpose of making unsymptomatic rhythm abnormalities go away. That was not that physicians didn't do that. Sometimes they did. I'll return to that. But that was not recommended, and the labeling actually discouraged that use.
I think the key change that the FDA made in its thinking on the anti-arrhythmic drugs was that first, the FDA wanted to restrict use of these drugs to patients with life-threatening conditions who were in the hospital, under a doctor's care in the hospital, so that the side effects could be monitored very carefully. But then the FDA changed its opinion on that and let the drugs be used also for people with serious symptoms associated with irregular heartbeats, and let the drugs be prescribed for patients who weren't in the hospital. What exactly changed your thinking on that?
The company presented a lot of new data and the results of additional studies that we interpreted as showing that the risks in people without these life-threatening arrhythmias were very small. We couldn't say they were zero, but were very small. And that, therefore, the drug could be used in selected patients like that, and that it was not necessary to hospitalize them. They addressed the very question that we raised.
One of the morals of this story, as told by Thomas Moore in his book Deadly Medicine, is that the FDA backed down on its initial judgment to restrict the drug to patients with life-threatening illnesses who would receive the medication while under hospital care. And he says the FDA backed down because of pressure from the pharmaceutical company. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm very conscious of the pressure word because people have used it. I think it depends on what you mean by pressure. What the company did in response to our initial letter is send me a half-inch thick document in which they reported on new cases and did new analyses. They didn't call my boss. They didn't call a congressman. They didn't call many people in the scientific community to tell me I was wrong. All they did was respond. Now, you know, if that's pressure, I'm not sure that's, I don't think that's what most people would mean by pressure. People have more nasty things in mind. I think the company did nothing but sustain its argument in the ordinary scientific way. The implication that something sinister happened just isn't correct.
My guest is Dr. Robert Temple. He directs the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. His office is criticized in a new book called Deadly Medicine about a controversial heart drug prescribed for irregular heartbeats. Is there ever a problem, in your estimation, of conflict of interest where doctors on FDA panels are also paid consultants to pharmaceutical companies?
Well, that is certainly an issue, and I'll tell you how we try to handle it. First of all, the judgments of these panels are advisory to us, and we, the people who have to make the final decision, are scrupulously avoid anything that could resemble a conflict of interest. We can't own shares in anything remotely related to what we regulate. Our advisors frequently are people who have carried out studies of drugs, and it's hard to argue that that's undesirable. I mean, you would want, we want the best people in the field, and one would hope that drug companies would ask the best people in the field to carry out their studies. That, in some sense, is how it ought to work. We have rigorous conflict of interest requirements. You can't serve on a panel that's reviewing work you did that was critical to the approval. If a scientist has studies ongoing with a company at the moment, he can't participate in the vote. In some cases, the person can speak but not vote. We have a variety of things like that. And the basic principle is you avoid overt conflicts of interest, and if things are at the margin, you announce to everybody assembled at the meeting, all of which are public, what those conflicts might be. What Moore is talking about is mostly people who were paid for doing clinical studies by drug companies. Obviously, opinions on this sort of thing can vary, but that's not the same as working for the company, being a consultant to the company, or walking around the country giving speeches about the company's drug. Those are kinds of things that make a person something like an employee, and we would be very leery of those relationships. But doing a study for the company, not necessarily on this drug, is something that we do not consider to exclude a person. So I don't think that the people who do trials are captured in the way that Moore does. This committee, for example, the cardiorenal committee, in 1984 was advising us strongly to limit the labeling claims for antiarrhythmic drugs. They were concerned about the use of these drugs in people who didn't have any symptoms at all in order to try to prevent death. And they said, correctly, there's no evidence that these will prevent death. Any hint in the labeling that the drug should be used for people who don't have symptoms is bad practice. We don't think the labeling should recommend that. And they were busily advising us to correct some old labeling that didn't make that distinction clearly. So their behavior was not very supportive of drug companies' interests, which would be to expand, presumably would be to expand the use of the drug as widely as possible. So these very people who are charged by Moore with having gotten their priorities confused were advising us in very strong terms to limit the claims for these kinds of drugs. And in those and in private conversations, they don't act like they're slavishly loyal to drug companies. So I think one has to be conscious of the potential for conflict of interest, obviously, but I don't think these people had that problem. And we think we managed this properly.
Thomas Moore's book, Deadly Medicine, is subtitled, Why Tens of Thousands of Heart Patients Died in America's Worst Drug Disaster. Do you think that's an accurate description of what happened, or is that hyperbole to you?
Well, it's hyperbole. Let me say what we know. There is one thing we know. We know from the Heart and Lung Institute's study that patients who had had a recent heart attack and who were treated with these drugs to clean up their electrocardiogram in an attempt to save their lives, but nonetheless, that's what was being done to them, almost surely died more frequently than they should have. The only population we know about is that population, people with a recent heart attack with extra abnormal beats. What Moore does is apply the same mortality increase that occurred in that study to everybody who got any antiarrhythmic drug in the country. And there is no basis that I can see for making that extrapolation. That's where he gets the kinds of numbers he does. I have no doubt that there were deaths in patients with heart attacks who got those drugs in an attempt to save their lives because the drugs didn't save lives. They took lives. And it's a considerable, that was a very unfortunate outcome. And there's no question, many, many people died. The exaggeration of this by applying, as I said, the same figure to everybody got the drug, I cannot see how that makes any sense.
My guest is Dr. Robert Temple. He directs the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. His office is criticized in a new book called Deadly Medicine about a controversial heart drug prescribed for irregular heartbeats. We heard from the author of that book, Thomas J. Moore, earlier in today's show. Let's look at one of the larger questions about the testing process. What Thomas Moore says in his book Deadly Medicine is that studies of new drugs don't necessarily analyze the drug's benefit to the patient. Sometimes they just analyze laboratory data. If the laboratory data will be changed, for instance, will a drug give you a better-looking cardiogram? That's what the test will look at, as opposed to will this drug help you prevent a heart attack? Will it increase the length of your life? Is this a problem in testing?
It's a very important question. And it applies not just to antiarrhythmic drugs, but it applies to many kinds of drugs. And we talk about three different kinds of endpoints of a study, that is, things you're trying to show. The most gratifying thing to show is that a drug improves survival. Another gratifying thing to show, an important thing to show, is that it improves a troublesome symptom. That's a perfectly legitimate reason to use a drug. For some things, for some kinds of drugs, it has been considered sufficient to show that an important measurement that is thought to relate to death is improved. For example, long before it was proved that lowering cholesterol was good for you, drugs were approved to lower cholesterol. The labeling said it hasn't been proved that these drugs improve your survival. But there was a lot known about cholesterol. It was well known epidemiologically that high cholesterols were associated with increased mortality and extra heart attacks and so on. And we long ago made the decision that we didn't feel no drug should be approved before the unequivocal demonstration that lowering cholesterol with a drug would improve survival. There was huge amounts of data showing an association of death with high cholesterol, and although we asked people to carry out those studies after marketing, we didn't wait for approval to approve those drugs. Now, the data are coming in on cholesterol lowering, and they are certainly reported as showing unequivocal improvements in survival and reduction in heart attacks from lowering cholesterol. So in that case, the use of what's called the surrogate endpoint, cholesterol rather than survival, looks like it was a correct and extremely important decision, one that saved many lives by having those drugs available. It would have been very hard for the agency to take the position that no agents that lower cholesterol could be approved until unequivocal evidence of improved survival was available.
And that would have been hard. Wait, let me stop you there. Would have been hard because it would have taken a very long time to prove that?
We didn't even know whether studies big enough to show that could even be done. We know that now because much larger studies have been carried out. It would have been difficult because you can't always base decisions on all the evidence you'd like. One of the things that I don't think Tom understands is that the decision to do something and the decision not to do something are both decisions. What he seems to think is that the only decision that matters is the decision to do something. That is, that you should never do anything ever until you know. Now, our rules unequivocally require that companies prove what they say in the label. That is, they prove that the drug lowers cholesterol. They also require that there be good reason to think that whatever they do is meaningful. But we have not said that you always have to have, for example, the mortality data in hand. And I think the answer is that when there's overwhelming epidemiologic and experimental support for something like the ability of drugs to lower cholesterol, there would be a certain arrogance in insisting that we have to have mortality data before anybody in this country can treat a high cholesterol. That would be a remarkable thing to require. And what I think is important is you can lose by saying yes or by saying no.
What would you say to people who are taking drugs for irregular heartbeats now, the drugs in question that were discussed by Thomas More in his book?
Well, as every show on this and as More says, don't do anything without talking to your doctor. I mean, that's quite clear. If a person who has an abnormal rhythm that represents the approved uses, that is, the uses that are in the approved labeling, may want to talk to the physician about it, but we're convinced that those approved uses ought to be are valid and ought to be approved. It's a good idea, I would say, for patients and physicians to know when they're going beyond what the labeled uses say. That doesn't mean they shouldn't ever do it, but they ought to be conscious of the fact that the company has not been able to persuade us yet that such a use is valid and that there may be reasons to think about it.
What's the lesson of the story for the FDA? Looking back, do you think you did something wrong? What would you do different?
Well, no, I don't think we did anything wrong. We didn't approve the use that caused trouble because we were worried about that use. It's a fact, though, that physicians don't always have to share our worries and can use drugs in ways that we haven't approved. I think there's a message to the community, a reminder that before you have the data, you can't be sure what the outcome will be. That's very important. More makes that point. We make that point. But that doesn't always tell you what the right thing to do is. Sometimes before the data are in hand, You have to act anyway. You had to treat high blood pressure before we knew that it saved lives, and it was the right thing to do. You had to treat lower cholesterol. It turns out that it was probably good to lower cholesterol before we knew. But it was not good to suppress abnormal beats in people who had a heart attack with flecainide. That was one where people's attempt to do good didn't work out.
Dr. Robert Temple is the director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation.